views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today, we're going to dive deeper into the deep state, and I'm going to bring on somebody with a different perspective, somebody who has a ton of background and would have insight from congressional perspective. I'm bringing on Cynthia McKinney, who spent 12 years in Congress and six terms, and she also was the 2008 Green Party presidential candidate. She's going to come on and share with us her experiences while she was in Congress. There's a video that went viral of her questioning Rumsfeld and others on 9/11. She was one of the few voices in Congress that was willing to take them to task and ask them what was actually going on. And she was one of the most ethical people in Congress because she had an ethics czar in her office and she was squeaky clean, so nobody had anything on her. So she was questioning people and digging in and doing her job, and she had a lot of enemies. And so she's going to explain that, what happened, and her views since. She's also spent time on the ground in Libya and in Syria and understands it from that perspective. And so she's going to share her insights on what's really going on the ground in Syria and what happened in Libya, and also what's going on in the Middle East in general. We also talk about how and whether it's possible to bring together people of color and people on the right and form a coalition of different people and alternative parties so that we can bring integrity back to our government and whether that's possible. It seems like there's a lot of alignment on major issues from people that think they're on the left and think they're on the right, but really maybe we're all kind of aligning on certain things. We might not agree with how the government should be run, but we agree on a lot of the big issues. So we're going to talk about that as well. So let's get right into that interview with Cynthia McKinney.
Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to see you, happy to know you, happy to get to know you.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you came. You're a icon in this country. And I'm really glad that you were able to join the program and share with us your immense experience in Washington, D.C., and then what you've done since then, because you've been really active in trying to help people around the world and in our country, and you have a keen insight as to what's going on, and that's what we're going to try to get at today.
Okay, very good.
Well, let's start with your experience in Congress, because you were a congresswoman for 6 years for Georgia, right?
Well, actually, six terms. So
I was that's what I meant. Six terms. Yes.
Years. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. I was thinking terms and I said years. Okay, so while you were there, I've heard some interesting comments that you've made in other interviews. So we don't have to, you know, really talk about a lot of that, but I want to go further into some of those comments. And one of the things that you mentioned that I wanted to talk about was when the whole 9/11 thing, you have that famous questioning scene and everybody's seen it. That video went viral. But one of the things that you said about that is that they gave you talking points that you needed to repeat. So first of all, who gave you talking points? And was that a common thing that you saw? You know, did they commonly give you talking points?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to understand the nature of Congress. So basically, you have in the House of Representatives, you have people who are elected for 2-year terms. And so the representatives come and go. Now, I know that's not the popular perception, but the representatives are a part of the non-permanent representation. What becomes permanent is the staff. And so you have staffers that go from office to office to office to office as the members of Congress change. And that's the situation basically that exists on Capitol Hill. And then over on the Senate side, although I never served in the Senate, the terms are much longer. So you have a 6-year term. But then what is required for you to remain there is such that your attention can be drawn toward something else. And we'll talk about that something else a little bit later as well. So basically what you have is the staff on the House and the Senate sides. And they basically run the show. So if you have influence over a staffer, that influence then extends to the member of Congress. So basically placement of staff in congressional offices becomes important. And then relationships with staff in congressional offices become important. And so now you see, as the newbie going in, I wasn't aware of any of this, right? And because of, I guess, my nature, I love to do research. I love to read.
Which is good. You know, that's what we want. Not there, though, right?
But that's not what the special interests, that's not what they want. They don't want an informed member of Congress who's going to press and press and press on certain issues. So basically what they prefer is to have this relationship with the staffers. The staffers are the ones who are the experts on the various issues. And when the staffer chooses to become an expert on a particular issue, then you could see the member of Congress actually leaning in that direction or making sure that they have staff who are experts in that particular area. So now what happens is, the question is, where did the talking points come from? And the short answer is, I don't know.
People didn't know? I mean, they just randomly showed up? Was it the head of the parties?
When we had for example, the talking points generally come from staff. But in this particular instance of 911, I can't say where they came from, but they all basically said the same thing. We were hit because we were free. And that was my basic objection, because I understand that the U.S. taxpayers have spent trillions of dollars for a military and an intelligence infrastructure, and it failed 4 times in one day. And I need, because, you know, my father was in the Georgia legislature. I was also in the Georgia legislature with my dad, which was kind of unique. But the one thing my father always told me was that taxpayers' money is sacrosanct. And so, therefore, you don't vote for tax increases. You don't do this. You don't do that without a solid rationale.
And, absolutely.
Yes. And then you also don't vote spending bills without a solid rationale. And so when you take the inventory of, say, for example, the Pentagon itself, that is designed for power projection around the world, and it can't even defend its headquarters, you got a problem. Houston, we got a problem, you know?
Exactly.
And so this is, I mean, when you look at the series of events that took place on September 11th, it is clear for any critical thinking person, let alone member of Congress, that there were tremendous failures that needed to be investigated. And so basically what started my travails was I understood that National Transportation Safety Board kicks into action whenever there's a plane crash, a train derailment, any kind of, and so there's these independent investigations. National Transportation Safety Board is independent of the Democrats and the Republicans, purely professional, go in there and with the power that they have are able to make design changes, to force design changes when they find flaws in design. And so, I mean, you know, there was supposed to have been some kind of design analysis of what happened on September 11th so that the design of the system could be perfected to make sure that that didn't happen again. And I remember women were interviewed in the press. And they said, oh, we don't want this to happen again. Okay, no, we don't want it to happen again. So what was the flaw in the system that allowed this to happen? That was never given to us. That information was never given to us. And so instead, we were supposed to be satisfied with we were hit because we were free. I was not satisfied.
Well,
and there
it's so obvious.
My problem.
There were so many obvious flaws, right, with 9/11. Right. I mean,
yes.
You look back. It's very well documented. Anybody with a relatively open mind and a brain,
yes,
and who's
yes,
willing to watch some of this stuff and dig into it knows there's issues with 9/11. I don't know what happened, but I do know that the government story is not quite right. Right. I mean, there's
that's
just
right.
Having half a brain, you just know that. Okay.
That's right.
Right. I mean, it's just, and now when you question them, what kind of backlash did you get? Did you experience
was it
behind your back or was it also in your face?
It was in my face. It was in public. It was all on national television. Okay, so what happened was, first thing, I wrote an op-ed when basically I was outraged because there was no investigation. There was a push for there to be no investigation. In fact, both Dick Cheney and George W. Bush had phoned the leadership of the Congress and said, please don't have any investigation. One of them, I can't remember which one now, actually came to Capitol Hill and said, don't have an investigation.
You're kidding
and Congress
me.
Was basically, no.
That's incredible. That's probably well documented. I didn't hear it.
That's documented, yes. And so that therein lies my point of departure. So but you have to understand that I came into the Congress with certain information anyway. I didn't call it the deep state at that time, but you have to understand my own background and my own interests that I brought with me to the Congress. And this is what I used to say all of the time when I was studying international relations in grad school. I would say that the government is comprised of individuals who bring with them into the government their own perceptual screen. So I had my own perceptual screen that I had taken to Washington, D.C. That screen included knowledge of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, of which I had become quite a student. And that in and of itself has some history because my father was one of the first, he was one of the first black police officers in the city of Atlanta, which brought problems on our family, anyway. But then he was politically active in the civil rights movement, which compounded those problems. And so I understood surveillance, because that kind of thing was happening to us. I understood political targeting, for elimination from political office, from public office. I understood all of that because it was happening all around me to all of my father's friends. And so, so I brought that in. And then I had also this knowledge. My undergraduate studies were in international relations, my graduate school, the Fletcher School of Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. There I studied international relations, got my master's in international relations. And then I read the book by John Stockwell, In Search of Enemies. I read all of this prior to my actually joining the Congress. And so I had these very powerful lessons about what the United States government really was. Not what it is portrayed to be or how it defines itself, but I knew from hard experience what the United States really was. And so I was exposed to that soft underbelly of grit, dirt, crime, corruption. You know, I got that. And so that awareness then led me onto the International Relations Committee. I was outraged at U.S. foreign policy, and onto the Agriculture Committee because my district, first district, they redistricted me literally every 2 years to try and get me out. That was
that just means you're powerful. That means you're making a difference.
Yes. I was trying anyway. And so anyway, I wrote. So when it became clear that there was not going to be any credible investigation of September 11th, then I wrote an op-ed that appeared in my local newspaper and in the Washington Post. That was the beginning of the end. Juliet Alperin then took that op-ed, very reasoned, rational op-ed, and said, conspiracy theory, McKinney conspiracy theorist. And then Tucker Carlson showcased it on Fox. Oh, she's a kook, she's a loon, she's this, she's that. And
did he have you on? Did Tucker Carlson have you on?
They talked about me.
Well, that's great.
But didn't have me on. And actually, you know, it was the op-ed that went around the world. I should say it was more Juliet Alperin's response to my op-ed that went around the world, because Juliet Alperin was the one who started it. And so now that I know what I know about the media, because I've done more research into the Frank Church Committee reports about media outlets, journalists, even preachers were on CIA payroll back in the 1970s. I understand that certain media outlets are controlled by the CIA. They were doing domestic, even though they had no business doing that, because their charter calls for external looking approaches rather than internal looking approaches. And quite frankly, the meeting that just took place down in New Zealand with the Five Eyes, the Five Eyes is all about making sure that the CIA can say, okay, I didn't do it, but New Zealand did it, or Australia did it, or the UK did it. So they're partners in a kind of crime, right? And that's why they're Five Eyes. Well, anyway, I also call it, Gilad Atzmon calls it identitarian politics, and I would call it also identitarian politics, to borrow his language. But anyway, so this denigration, caricaturing, turning my rational questions into fodder for a cartoon.
Well, and it's so questions that any rational person would ask. It just, you couldn't.
Nobody asked those questions. Nobody asked those questions.
Go ahead.
Thing. I believe that if a white male member of Congress had asked those questions, then maybe we would have gotten closer to some answers. Or maybe it would have been handled differently. But I'm a Black girl from the South? Come on. You know, I'm not supposed to be asking the powers that be to explain themselves. I'm not even supposed to be able to see through their lie because I'm really supposed to be quite ignorant, quite dumb, you know. Yes, sir, boss. And so anyway, I was never that. And I was just the inconvenient, spunky kid who didn't deserve to be in Washington, D.C. representing 650,000 people or, in the larger sense, 300 million people.
Well, I think you touched a nerve, though, with a lot of people, because a lot of people were asking those questions, and you're out there just...
Not at that time.
Well, okay, this is a question...
I was criticized, but this is a question that I have.
Said,
well, it's not the proper time to ask that question.
And that's what I asked. That's what I wanted to ask you was, because they were beating the war drums... Was it everybody had to get in line? Because if you do question us at all, you're not a patriot. You are not for the United States.
Well, no, it didn't really get to the she's not patriotic. That came later.
It did come.
Because, you know, when they have an arsenal at their disposal, and they launched the first strike, and it doesn't quite hit the target. Then you go back and you say, okay, what else do I have in my panoply of weapons here that is going to totally decimate and destroy her? And so they went this boom, 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 until they got the mother of all bombs.
What was the mother of all bombs? What was that one?
Well, the mother of all bombs was when I started talking about, well, you know, what really goes on in Washington, D.C. and who controls D.C. and, you know, I didn't sign the pledge and, you know, blah, 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 and all this sort of stuff. And so the 911 thing was... I mean, it lived with me, but it wasn't the final blow, right? It was when I gathered a conscience, quite frankly, about the votes that Congress cast with respect to Israel and Palestine. And that really was the final blow. And so after I was, I mean, you know, they tried little things to make my life difficult. They actually tried to get me to go along with the program. Cynthia, I get a phone call. Cynthia, when are you going to do this? You know, you can be on the front page of Newsweek and Time. You can stay in Congress for as long as you like. You can die there if you want to. That was offered to me. But I had to lie in order to do it. I had to lie in order to stay there. What they particularly wanted from me was,
And who was they? Who would you say is they?
Well, you see, the supreme power in D.C. is the Israel lobby. In my opinion, people talk about the gun lobby, the insurance lobby. What else? They're very powerful. The bankers, very powerful. But you see, the bankers and the it's sort of committee specific. So, like, for example, if you're on the Ways and Means Committee, then you have a certain group of special interests that converge there, and they control, you know, basically most of the members of Congress that are there, because that's where the money that is raised by those members of Congress come from. So you have a division, like, for example, where some committees are known as money committees. And the goal and the dream of most members of Congress is to get on the money committee. Because if you can get on one of those money committees, then you the campaign dollars will flow, and then you will be able to stay in Congress. You know, you can die there. But there's something, I believe, that dies inside of you.
Yes.
Okay. And that's why I didn't, all of their tricks, they never worked with me, because I wasn't interested in, you know, it's what, wine, women, and song. I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't interested in money. I just was elected. I was willing to live within my means, to live on my salary, and to do the work that came with the job. Now, I understood separation of powers, checks and balances, the role of the legislative branch, the executive branch. You know, I understood maybe a little bit too much. And so that's how you see those powerful scenes about me questioning Rumsfeld. Well, that's a part of my responsibility. It's a part of the checks and balances system that we have in the United
States.
That's the way the government is structured. And so, therefore, if I don't do that, I, as a member of Congress, set the policy. And it's the responsibility of the executive branch to carry out that policy. And if I see a deviation from the policy that I have been a part of setting, then it's my responsibility to call the executive branch on the floor and have them explain themselves. That's my responsibility as a member of Congress. And so what I did with Colin Powell, Madeleine Albright, I was equal opportunity. I didn't care if it was Democrat or Republican. I was just going for the information. And Michael Chertoff, you can go back to the C-SPAN archives and you can find me with all of them. And the situation got so bad that Madeleine Albright would start calling the congressional office in advance of her appearance before the House International Relations Committee and say, what is Cynthia gonna ask today? Kind of thing, you know, because I was completely, my questions were completely out of the box and informed. For example, we've got the recent news that President Trump used the mother of all bombs, the Moab bomb, against training camps in Afghanistan. Well, I just happened to have been aware of the fact that this is going way, way, way back. I can't even remember the year now. I guess this was after September 11th, and there's all this information coming out about Osama bin Laden, you better be afraid. Okay, so then the members of Congress, the House International Relations Committee is having State Department experts come and talk to us. And so they basically are, you know, going on this Osama bin Laden thing, and we've got to be afraid of him. And one of my colleagues then asked a question about, well, what's the relationship between the U.S. government and Osama bin Laden? And he kind of fluffed it off. And then I asked, would the gentlewoman yield? And so before her time was up, she yielded to me. And so then I got my time and her time. And I said, is it not true that the United States government spent hundreds of millions of dollars building tunnels in Afghanistan, and that complex, that training complex, was built by the bin Laden family? And so then what totally changed was he knew he couldn't fluff me off with his response. And then he came back. You can search the congressional record on this. And then he came back and said, well, that money was spent for construction. It was spent with the family, but it didn't go to Osama. But now, come on, it's just a category, right? And so when Trump launches this bomb, he's bombing what the U.S. built. And so, you know, we have no way of really knowing what the heck is going on over there. And then Mattis just said the other day that we're not even going to do an investigation. But okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that as long as the staff are in charge of the questions, then they're also in charge of the answers. They're in charge of the questions that the members ask. They're also in charge of the answers that the members get.
And most of
I was unpredictable in that regard.
Well, because you were a self-thinking, independent person. And most of the people follow what the staff does, right? They kind of get in there enamored with their position and just kind of go with the flow instead of being an activist, somebody who really wants to get something accomplished.
I come from an activist background. And so I took my activism into the body. But that's the problem. I mean, you know, we need more activists in Congress, basically.
Well, we do.
Yes, that's right. That's what we need. We need activists.
People with integrity.
Well, yeah. Now, here's the other thing. So, you know, it came out that Jesse Jackson Jr. followed in his father's footsteps. Well, let's put it this way. Jesse Jackson Jr. Was wearing a wire for the FBI. And so conversations that members of Congress were having were being like spied upon, right? But we know it was Jesse Jr. We don't know who else. But okay, so you see, when Trump says we got to drain the swamp, you have to know what's in the swamp in order to know how to dive through all of the muck that's in the swamp to find the plug so you can pull it and drain it. And that means that you've got to have had experience in that swamp or else anything could derail you. And that's why on my Twitter feed, which is Cynthia McKinney, I have been harping on ethics. Ethics, the ethics failures that I knew were going to come as a result of the divergence between corporate ethics and public governance ethics. So the reason they had to resort to all of these different tools, because the first tools, the easy ones, you know, the setup with the women and the prostitutes, or in my case, the men, and the prostitutes and, you know, all of that kind of thing, that didn't work with me.
Did they try?
I wasn't interested in going.
Did they try to set you up?
Not with me, but with other people. Yeah. And, you know, the newspaper headlines are there. We know the D.C. madam, right? We know about the Sybil Edmonds deposition, right? We know about, you know, this Abramoff, Jack Abramoff, you know, going on those trips. Who knows what was going on those trips, right? And then there was the regular activities like taking trips, these strange trips to Asia and stuff like that. That's on public dime. And then there's, you know, the Page scandal. I don't have to go through all this stuff. But so, you know, generally what happens is good people get elected. They go to Washington. They're all excited. And they become a swamp monster.
And it's not, and do you think their intentions are to be good, but they get roped into some bad things and then they are blackmailed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And I think, but now, that was my trajectory of what I saw. And so the strange people are the ones who fight it. And those are the ones who are denigrated in the press. So, for example, like in the way I had organized the congressional office, and because this was just because I had background from my dad and understood, you know. So that I hired an ethics czar in the office. That ethics czar could override me. And that's the way, that's very unusual in a congressional office that the member of Congress is overridden by a staff person. But I made it known that that was the way the office was organized.
I love that, because I teach ethics at the university. So for the business school right now. And so I love that, but keep going.
Okay. And so when his name was Mark, and when Mark said, "Cynthia, you can't do that," then it wasn't done, because I'm always and the staff knew. And not only the staff, but the special interest knew. And it could be something simple like taking a trip or something, you know, outside sponsored travel. And there was one example where one member of Congress begged me, literally begged me, "Please, Cynthia," because what had happened was I was invited to go. Several members of Congress were invited to go. They went. I didn't go. But for some reason, I can't remember now, the host really, 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 really wanted me. And so he called and he begged and he begged and he begged. I remember saying to him, the answer is no. And I can put Mark on the phone and he can tell you why the answer is no. Well, then the other members of Congress started calling me and saying, "Cynthia, please don't tell anybody we're going," because it was patently against the House ethics rules. And I just wasn't going to breach them. Well, that was the stewardship with which I led the congressional office, ethics first, constituents first, USA first. And then that's when I ran into all the problems that came after that.
Okay, I have a few questions on this. There was just a 60 Minutes article or episode talking about the fact that 75% of Congress people's time is on raising money. In fact, they're expected to go to the headquarters, sit in a little cubicle, and make phone calls like a sales rep. And they spend they're supposed to spend 30 hours a week, which is essentially 75%. Was that expected of you, or was that a new thing that they've been doing? I mean, has that expectation relatively new, or has it been enacted since you were there as well?
Yeah, that was the practice when I was there. I didn't do it. I mean, I had to go and raise money, but you're raising money from special interests. And so what ultimately happens is then you become beholden to those special interests, because there's a list that they give you, call lists. And the call list consists of the representatives of the PACs that are representatives of the corporations or the labor unions, and the ideological PACs. So they haven't broken down ideological PACs. Ideological PACs. Then there's corporate PACs. There's, you know, broken down by industry and that sort of thing. And they never gave me any money because I was, you know, they didn't give me money. And if they, even Emily's List, there, and there's the ugly underbelly to that system as well, because that's how then not just special interests, but particular special interests that have access, unfettered access to unlimited amount of money, that's how they come to control the system.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that could be foreigners as well.
Okay, can I ask you questions? It's a little deviating, but this is something that's really important to me, and I've done a lot of episodes on this, and I just talked to my class this past week on it. It was one of the topics, the mass incarceration issue. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. We incarcerate at 8 times the average rate of other first world countries, you know, at our peers. Children are incarcerated at those levels as well. People are not getting, 96% of the people that don't go to trial, they end up, they're all guilty. They all have to settle and they get a guilty plea and they go to jail. So that's probably one of the reasons why we have such mass incarceration issues. The public defenders are way underfunded. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, to me, it is a... it's crimes against humanity, and it's a national embarrassment. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's not an embarrassment to the people who own the stock in the private prisons. They're making money off of it.
Yeah, but taxpayers are paying way more than they should for it. I mean,
absolutely.
So are we really willing to say, okay, these private four people that own these prisons are going to get the billions of dollars we could save? We're wrecking our communities. We're hurting our communities. We're wrecking families. We're spending billions of dollars more than we need to. We look like a fool in the international space. Every country sees our numbers and thinks, what's going on in the United States, so that we can enrich some private people who own some prisons? I mean, it makes no sense.
Why are we dropping bombs? Why are we dropping bombs on Afghanistan? Literally, as you and I speak, the United States is dropping bombs on Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. The United States has already divided Sudan. I mean, if you look at the carnage and the wreckage that the United States has constructed or implemented or is responsible for in the rest of the world, then locking up a few million people, I mean, well, that's nothing, right? And they're all just useless eaters anyway. They don't make any contribution to society that's worth anything. So we need to get rid of them. And this is the best way to do that, except who's not in prison? Lock her up.
Oh, yeah.
Who's not in
prison? Exactly.
Those people who commit state crimes against democracy,
exactly,
they don't get punished at all.
Exactly. Well, there are a lot of ramifications to our veterans. We have the suicide rate amongst our veterans is off the charts. According to government numbers, it's at 22 per day, right? And the people in the experts there say, we think that's really understated. The government always understates stuff. So why wouldn't that be understated? But even using their numbers, it's bad. Some people say it's up to 33, the experts that I've talked to. But regardless, I charted it. And over, because it's been happening for at least a decade. And I charted a decade, 10, and I charted 15 years. We have already bypassed the losses that we've had in Vietnam just with our suicide rates. And we're already at the level of World War I losses of our veterans committing suicide. So the impact of these wars and things that we're making these people do is having a dramatic effect on our people and our communities. It's like we don't even care about the people in this country. You know, I mean, we lock people up. We don't care about anybody.
Of course not. So what makes the people of the United States think that the government cares about them? I mean, you know, Why do you think they care about you? They don't care about you. And I stand here as a perfect example of people not caring. So you've got this system that allows the criminals to go free, to walk the streets unhampered, unharmed. And you've got people who are the victims of an unjust system, and they're locked away because, quite frankly, they're inconvenient. They are, you know, their anger is misplaced. And so instead of striking out at a system that is unjust, they strike out at each other. And therein lies the basically the substance of my message that has been for quite a while, because as a Southerner, I have seen transformation. I just posted on my Facebook page, which is Cynthia McKinney Official. I just posted on my Facebook page, hey, I remember that. I was there in Decatur, Alabama. It was the first time I saw the Klan. They were all dressed up in their regalia. They had rifles. The National Guard had been called out. And we were protesting to save the life of a young man who was mentally challenged, had been accused of raping a white woman, you know, the typical charge. And but, you know, they wanted to kill it. And so we were saying, of course, against the death penalty. So saying, no, let's, you know, have some compassion here and understand what might actually the totality of the circumstances that might have happened. So anyway, the attitudes, I just posted it because, you know, where we came from as a country, and particularly in the South, that's why, you know, when I find a good Southern white man that's been through redemption, you can't beat them. I mean, you know, in terms of values and principles and having done, taken the time to be introspective and look and say, okay, let me look at my role in this and let me see where I fit in. You know, let me see what I can do to transform myself as well as the system. And so I saw that in operation when the powers that be went after John Edwards. Of course, he made it easy for them to do so. But this Southern man who's been through that rough, rough, rough time and says, okay, comes out on the other side and says, look, we've got to do better as a country. His message is no different than that of Bobby Kennedy. His promise was no different than that of JFK. And, you know, his fallibility was fallibility of most men. And so his whole political career was derailed. But the point is that I've been up close with members of the militia, Christian Identity, Ku Klux Klan members. When I first ran for Congress in 1992, it was the first time I'd even been inside rural Georgia. And in some of the towns I campaigned in, actually, you can see the story was done. I think Time Magazine or somebody came down and did a story of people refusing to shake my hand because of the racial polarization. And I was told, I hit one town and I was told, you better not be here come sundown. You know, so this is 1992. This is not 1952. This is 1992 that I was told, get out of town before the sun goes down. And so after I won the congressional seat in what basically was labeled a gerrymandered district to empower Black people to rule over white people. Basically, what I did was I said, okay, we're going to have unity meetings. And I learned a lot in the process of those unity meetings. But I remember, I'll never forget, I had one mayor of a small town whisper in my ear, Cynthia, you really did it, because even the Klan is here. And that was my purpose, was, okay, we do have something called the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We do have something called the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We do have something called the 1968 Fair Housing Act. It is not 1950s. It's the 1990s. And so, therefore, we're going to behave as if it's 1990. And I went into every nook and cranny of the district after I won. And there were some districts some counties in Georgia, you have to understand, with the racial polarization the way it is, some counties totally, totally, totally white. No Black people. It's like no Black people allowed, so no Black people go there. And I went to those counties as the congresswoman, though, so with the protection. And they said, it's the first time anybody ever came to us. And so then what I learned was that whites in the U.S. thought they had representation, but they only had a representative, just like Black people did. And in the form of governance that we have, a government that we have, people strive politically for representation, not just to have a representative.
Well, exactly.
And so what I tried to do was to bring representation to every voice in my district. And so I was given the opportunity to act. They wouldn't come to me. There was like a boycott. So, like, for example, one of the first things I did was I organized farmers, because we were in the middle of a drought in Georgia. So I organized my farmers to go up to Washington and plead their case for drought relief and extra assistance so that we wouldn't suffer so much. In many respects, because, of course, you know, the food prices go up and all that sort of thing. So you want to have your food supply protected at all costs. And none of the white farmers came. Not a single white farmer from my district came. I had two white farmers to show up because they heard about it, but they were in another district. So I had a busload of farmers who did go. They were all Black. And none of the white farmers except the two. We went to Washington, did everything, was so successful. Then after we were so successful, then the white farmers called and called me to come. And they said, Cynthia, I asked them, I said, how come you didn't come? And they said, Cynthia, we just didn't know. They didn't know that I would represent them just like I would represent anybody else. So, you know, there's lots of, I've got lots of experiences and lots of stories of transformation and belief that people are good. And I firmly believe that we can find the good in people. All we have to do is just be open and allow it to manifest.
So you think we can get past the black-white nonsense? I mean, is this?
It's not nonsense.
It's not nonsense because there's a lot of historical stuff going on that's causing it. It's real.
But
it's still nonsense. You know what I'm saying?
No, it's not nonsense. When, you know, when people were beaten.
That's not nonsense. That's real and that's awful. But
that's real.
It's very real.
I know. It's nonsense. But what I.
But for there to be. But for us to judge each other based on nonsense reasons, I mean, we should be able to get past that.
But it's not nonsense.
But don't you think. But don't you think skin's color is a nonsense reason? Oh, come on. Skin color is a nonsense reason for us not to get along.
Skin color is why I'm here in the first place. And when I say here, I mean inside the United States, but why I'm here in the first place, right?
What do you mean by that?
Skin color.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that my entire being has been defined in the United States by my skin color. So it's not nonsense to me. But it's something that I'm proud of, but it's also something that I have to bear as the burden in this country.
It's very real, but it shouldn't. See, my husband's Mexican, right? And when I first met him, it didn't even dawn on me that he was just another person, you know, and then I started realizing as I learned the culture and different things. But the culture.
You can't walk through life oblivious to the hate that is expressed on a daily basis inside U.S. society.
Yeah, but I do.
Let's recognize that the
hate
Houston,
is still nonsense.
We got a problem.
But the hate is still nonsense. the real struggling is real.
It's nonsense. You can say that. I can't say it's nonsense.
I'm going to say it's
life and death.
Well, yes, but I'm going to say the reason simply skin color is a nonsense reason to not get along. I just think it is. I think culture can be different. You know, I mean, But one thing that I've noticed is that there's a lot more equality in how poorly we're treating each other at the bottom line, you know, like the mass incarceration and the children. There's a lot more equality down there. And it's more, if you can't afford an attorney, you're in bad shape. I mean, you're going.
It was probably always like that. I remember the trip that Bobby Kennedy made to Appalachia. I mean, you know, the people who live there have always had poverty as an issue and no national policy really addressed it. We've got Cancer Alley in Louisiana that has not been addressed. And so we've got more than enough to occupy our interests, ourselves, our government's attention, our taxpayer dollars right here at home. But for some reason, they never get the proper attention that they're supposed to have.
So do you think we could get a coalition of people of color to be, because there's a lot of people on the right as well that are not racist inside. They don't want to be. They might be because of culture and society, but they don't want to be. You know, they want to be good people. And I do think that there is this growing concept that people want integrity back in their in their government. They want people up there trying to solve issues. They might differ in how much you want government involved or not, all that stuff.
Right.
But they don't want criminals running the government. We don't want that.
Of course not. Of course not. We don't want criminals. But you see the things that happen. People could also be really mean, or I guess maybe drunk with power. When I first got onto the House Armed Services Committee, both Pat Schroeder and Ron Dellums asked me to take their spot from the House Armed Services Committee. And that's how I got there. And I had studied security studies. And so it was a natural for me to be there. But I was there to represent an unbound point of view when it comes to the role of the military in our society.
This is the end of part one of my interview with Cynthia McKinney. You can catch the remainder of these interviews. I'm going to air the other part on Wednesday, and you can always get it on my website at sarahwestall.com. Part one will be up there later today. And also, all of the interviews are up on YouTube now as well. So remember to subscribe to that and subscribe to my newsletter so you can get all the information on what's going on with my shows. And her contact information will be up on my website as well. So go there and get that. And I want to tell you for now, have an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.